The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by 5 local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Carl Rove. Hello, Carl.
Hey, Vic. How are you?
Excellent. Carl, you've got a new book out. It's The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. And back in the 19th century, Ohio was the place to get our presidents, and William McKinley was one of them, wasn't he?
Yeah, no Republican between Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt is elected president unless he was born in Ohio.
That's amazing. What happened after Warren Harding?
Well, I don't know, but Ohio still remains a battleground state. The reason they put so many Ohioans on the ticket was that Ohio was a battleground state. If you look at the battlegrounds after the Civil War, they are Indiana, Ohio, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And of those, Ohio was considered absolutely critical to Republican victory.
But if you were a favorite son like McKinley, he probably wasn't so concerned with Ohio, was he?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, he was. He was deeply concerned with Ohio because he'd been through two races in 1884 and 1888, and he had seen how a divided Ohio delegation had killed the chances of Senator John Sherman to be president of the United States, to be the Republican nominee for president. He himself had been sent to the 1884 convention reluctantly. He tried to avoid being sent as a delegate because he was for James G. Blaine. And he sat in the Ohio delegation as the blind judge, Judge West, nominates Blaine for president, and the future governor of the state, Joseph Fire Alarm Foraker, fumes at the betrayal of Sherman by West and McKinley. And then in 1888, he had been for Sherman. Hanna had taken command of the Sherman campaign, and the two men had joined with Sherman, reconciled themselves. McKinley had reconciled with Sherman, but again the delegation was divided, and Ohio was split. And so McKinley was worried deeply about Ohio running up to the 1896 campaign, particularly after the 1895 Ohio convention. Unexpectedly, he's leaving office as governor, and unexpectedly, Fire Alarm Foraker from Cincinnati reemerges and takes command of the convention and beats the McKinley men for everything. In fact, one of the reporters of the time says that the McKinley men didn't merely lose; they weren't even allowed to keep their sidearms. And so McKinley was deeply concerned about the Ohio delegation. And one of the things in the book is how he, Hanna has written off Foraker, the former two-term governor, has written him off publicly and has said, "I'm done with him. He was too big a burden in the past. I'm done with him." But McKinley keeps a personal rapport with Foraker and goes and seeks his support personally, individually, in his home in Cincinnati, and asks for his support, and then conciliates Foraker to him, despite the fact that when Foraker is running for a third term as governor, he basically accuses McKinley of being part of a cabal with his Democrat opponent to steal $1 million from the federal government. The Democrat nominee for governor, Campbell, has supposedly signed a deal with a ballot box manufacturer to pass a bill requiring a standardized ballot box in return for a share of the profits, and supposedly has gotten McKinley involved in this. Turns out to be a complete hoax, but Foraker's so desperate to get reelected, he doesn't care if he smears Congressman McKinley and Senator Sherman, whom he also alleges are part of this. But even after that, McKinley doesn't allow it to get under his skin and keeps Foraker inside the tent rather than outside the tent.
Carl Rove joins us. His book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. The thing that really comes through about McKinley is that he was very shrewd and incredibly patient. He could have probably run for president in 1892, but he didn't want to because he was biding his time, wasn't he?
He was, and he also was a man of enormous integrity. And having given his word to Benjamin Harrison, a man that he really didn't like that much. He wasn't going to break his word. But he's also practical because he looked at how badly messed up the economy was and said, you know, bad things are about ready to happen. Better for me, you know, better for me to keep my word, which is important to him, and not to look like I'm overly ambitious. But he could have been nominated in 1892, I think, if he had thrown himself into it, particularly if he'd thrown himself into it with the verve that he did for the 1896 election.
You go into a lot of detail here about the nominating process in these various elections, and it was really amazing to me to read about the process for the state nominating contests in places like Texas and Missouri in 1896. I mean, this was pretty wild stuff.
Yeah. No, look, this sounds like sort of, you know, the election of 1896, dry and boring. But it has got sex, it's got violence, it's got backstabbing, fraud, deception, betrayal. I mean, these state conventions, you mentioned the Texas one, it ends up 800 men go to beating the crap out of each other for 20 minutes because somebody's played the race card. For 25 years, the Texas Republican Party has been led by a well-educated, affluent, well-spoken African-American political leader named Norris Wright Cuny, and he's an ally of the Combine, the Republican political bosses who want to dominate the process, and he basically tries to steal the convention. He goes around to all the black delegates. There are 800 delegates at the convention, and about close to 600 of them are black. Many of them are from McKinley, and he's not. Cuny is not, and he says to them, I don't care who you are for president. Vote to make me the temporary chairman because they're trying to keep the black man down. And so these black delegates help elect him chairman of the convention, temporary chairman of the convention, over a Jewish Republican from Houston, Judge Rosenthal, who recognizes he's going to get beat and tries to withdraw during the balloting. And somebody stands up and says, we want to beat him. We don't want him to withdraw. We want to beat him. And they do, and Cuny takes control of the convention and then proceeds to throw out several hundred McKinley delegates and run roughshod over the majority of the convention, but never calls a roll call, never allows a roll call vote. He's losing all the voice votes, but he's declaring himself the winner of every one of them. And when they vote on the national convention delegates and he declares the McKinley men have been defeated, the McKinley men proceed to storm the stage, and literally a riot breaks out with pistols being pulled, straight razors, knives, bludgeons. The giant table at the front of the convention hall is busted up into pieces and used as weapons. Every chair in the place is smashed over somebody's head, and it takes the city police showing up 20 minutes later and literally clubbing everybody into insensibility to restore order in the convention. And this is not the only time there's a bitter physical fight at a state convention, Democrat or Republican.
Oh, those were the days. The book
those are the good old days.
The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Matters. McKinley's opponent in that election comes out of nowhere. When he goes to the Democratic convention, he's virtually unknown. No one has any clue that this guy's going to come out of the convention as their candidate. But before we talk about William Jennings Bryan, let's talk about the big issue in this campaign and the one that McKinley really didn't acknowledge very quickly, and that was currency. Tell us about that. Why was this so important, and what was this all about?
Well, this was an issue that's hard for us to get our hands around today. It is an issue of ostensibly what is money to be made of, and we had since the Civil War a currency that was bimetallic, that is to say, based on gold and silver, but in essence, gold was the principal. The principal metal, and silver played a subordinate role. They used silver coins for change, pocket change, but contracts and business deals had to be paid for in gold. And for 30 years, the Democratic Party had a growing element in it, mostly Southern and Western, and very agrarian, that believed that we needed to have free coinage of silver, by which they meant if you had silver from any mine in the United States or around the world, you could bring it to the U.S. Mint, and they would buy it from you in paper money, which was redeemable in gold or silver, and they would pay for it at a ratio of 16 to 1, that is to say 16 units of silver to 1 unit of gold. Now, the practical effect of this would be to create an inflationary currency, because a silver dollar, the size and shape of a silver dollar, contained only 52 cents worth of silver. So you'd have a gold dollar that would be worth a dollar, but you'd have a silver dollar that would be worth 52 cents. And obviously what people would do is hoard their gold coins and pay for things in inflationary half dollars, you know, worth 52 cents. And this would drive up prices. Now, it's hard for us to get our hands around this as being a big issue. I mean, but it was huge. It was unbelievable. And the reason was because at the heart of it was a big difference of opinion between the two parties as to how you create prosperity. And this ought to have a familiar ring. This is from Brian's Cross of Gold speech, in which he's talking about this fundamental issue that's at the heart of the battle of the standards, gold versus silver. He says, there are two ideas of government. Republicans believe if you just legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, then their prosperity will leak through on those below. Democrats believe if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up and through every class that rests upon it. And so really, this is an old issue that we keep talking about today. It's just that it's oriented around different things than it was oriented around in 1896.
The book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. Carl Rove wrote it. You can meet Carl later today. He'll be at Books & Company in Beaver Creek for a book signing at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And if you miss him in Dayton, he's got a couple more dates. He'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati at 7 o'clock Monday night. That's December 7th. And he'll be in Columbus at the Book Loft at Ohio State House, and that is on Tuesday at 12 noon, December 8th, at the Ohio State House in Columbus, as he hits Southwest Ohio pretty hard, like McKinley would have been doing during his campaign, except McKinley stayed home and had 750,000 people visit him there.
Yeah, with one of the amazing events of the election. Hannah was worried when Brian started, who was an incredible orator. He steamrolls the Democratic Convention with a Cross of Gold speech. And you're right, nobody thinks he's a candidate beforehand. In fact, the night before, the publisher of the Rocky Mountain News talks to Brian about supporting a candidate for the Democratic nomination. And Brian says, no, we're not going to do that. And so Patterson says to him, well, who do you think the nominee is going to be? And Brian says, well, I've got as good a chance as anybody. I've got Nebraska on the first ballot and half of the Oklahoma Territory on the second. And I'm sure there'll be others. And literally, Patterson walks away thinking, this guy is insane. He has no chance of getting the nomination. But he gets the nomination with this incredible speech and then goes on the road on his way returning home to Lincoln, Nebraska. And this causes Hannah and others to say, we got to get our man on the road. We got to get McKinley out on the road like he was in 1894 for the midterm elections. And McKinley said, no, I'm not going to do it. He said, you know, if he's on a trampoline, I got to be on a trapeze. You know, Hannah sends other friends to talk to McKinley. McKinley finally said, no, I have to think before I talk. I'm not going to do that. And so they sort of back into this, you know, people are showing up in Canton, and somebody, and I think it's McKinley, says, you know what, if they're showing up, why don't we keep going with that? Let's invite people to come. If they're just sort of showing up here and clogging up my day, why don't we just organize it so that people do come here to see me, and we have an organized day. They get off of the train in Canton, they go they muster up in front of the courthouse, they at a certain prearranged time they come up Market Street, they come to McKinley's house. Their remarks to him have been vetted in advance, so they know exactly what they're going to say to him. And he has written a specific speech for them for that day so that they can then give the copy of the speech to the press and they can, you know, drive home a message. And this becomes almost industrial in scale, with 100 or 150,000 people a weekend coming into Canton. And over the course of essentially September and October, 750,000 people come to Canton, Ohio, and visit with the Magi on his front lawn.
And probably the most spectacular delegation to show up, seeing how McKinley was the last Civil War veteran, Union veteran, to serve as president after he was elected. He actually brought in a group of Confederate veterans, and wow.
It's a,
What a PR moment.
Emotional moment. Emotional moment. October 9th, 1896. 2,000 Confederate veterans, most of them veterans of the Shenandoah Valley Campaign. These were men in the gray uniforms on the other side of the muskets and the cannons that had faced McKinley in the Shenandoah Valley. He is the first Republican presidential candidate ever to appear with Union veterans, and it is a deeply emotional moment for the country. It's a moment of national reconciliation. He quotes Washington, "There is no east, no west, no north, no south, but a common country." And he declares sectionalism was surrendered at Appomattox. And it's a deeply emotional moment. As you can imagine, these veterans who had fought each other in a contest that pitted region against region, brother against brother, American against American. And McKinley is seeking a moment of national reconciliation. Really powerful.
You said the first to appear with Union veterans. I think you meant Confederate.
Confederate veterans.
Gotcha.
Right. Yes.
Karl Rove joins us. The book is The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. You've mentioned the name Hanna a number of times. I think some of our listeners are probably wondering who that is.
Marcus Alonzo Hanna, whom history, I think, erroneously credits for being the man who makes things happen. And he does make things happen. But he is not the manager of McKinley, and he's not the brains of the operation. This is sort of an historic construct given to us by William Randolph Hearst, who owned the nation's largest newspaper and had decided to back Bryan, but it was also smart enough to know that McKinley was a man of enormous character and integrity. And so rather than to attack McKinley, he told his reporters and his cartoonists, go after Hanna. Always depict Hanna in the cartoons as overweight and dressed in a suit of dollar bills, and make McKinley a small puppet. And go after Hanna, not McKinley, but it is McKinley who's making the big strategic decisions. It's our man Hanna who's unfortunately being forced to endure the slings and arrows of the newspapers.
Another strategy that was employed during this period, which was intriguing to me, was the strategy of nominating favorite sons. And you have a group that you refer to as the Combine that was quite adept at this. Explain what this was all about and what the purpose was.
Well, the title The Combine was the name given to and accepted by the Republican Party bosses, led by the easy boss, former Senator Thomas Collier Platt of New York, who's the boss of the New York Republican Party. And among his allies is Senator Matthew S. Quay, who is the Republican chairman and political boss of Pennsylvania, and William J. Larmer, an Illinois congressman who is the boss of the Cook County Republican machine. He's called the blonde boss. And they have allies all around the country, and they have agents. One of their agents is James S. Rhett Clarkson, the publisher of the Des Moines Register, and another one is Joseph Manley, the Republican National Committee man from Maine. And their job is to organize for the convention. And the way that you organized for the convention was you got a lot of favorite sons, Senator Davis of Minnesota and Governor Bradley of Kentucky and Governor Morton of New York, to enter the contest. They're not really candidates for president, but they are the favorites of their states, and thereby they keep their delegation locked up so it can be dealt away at the national convention. The real candidates are Senator Allison of Iowa, and the front runner, the Speaker of the House, Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine. But there are lots of favorite sons out there sort of to keep the delegations united behind one person so they could be dealt as a group in return for patronage or posts in the cabinet or boodle money at the national convention. And what happens is McKinley takes this practice on and goes and refuses to. The traditional thing was, if you got a favorite son in the state, leave that state alone. And instead, he takes on those favorite son candidates and basically knocks virtually all of them out of the race by getting enough people to show up at, for example, the Minnesota State Convention in April to literally deny Senator Davis the support of his own state. In fact, they instruct for McKinley. And now there's a price to be paid. The guy who leads the Minnesota effort is former Governor Merriman, who had served in Congress with McKinley and was a pal of McKinley's. And Senator Davis is so furious with him that he confides afterward that he's been defeated by the whoring of Merriman. And when McKinley later nominates Merriman to be the ambassador to Germany, Davis, as the ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, proceeds to kill the nomination. So there are prices to be paid, but these favorite sons were a common practice of the time. But McKinley says, I'm not standing for that.
Amazing political intrigues, and they're recounted by Karl Rove in his new book, The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. And you can meet him today. He'll be at Books and Company this afternoon for a book signing at 1 o'clock. That's Books and Company at the Green in Beaver Creek. On Monday, December 7th, tomorrow, he'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati at 7 o'clock. And on Tuesday, he'll be at the Book Loft at the Ohio State House in Columbus at 12 noon as he makes his way through our area. Carl, this political intrigue is something that I know you are very well versed in and thoroughly enjoy. I'm sure every election cycle to you is absolutely a delight to try to figure out what's going to happen, who's going to get nominated, who's going to do this, who's going to do that. And I guess I should mention that your background in politics goes back a long ways. Some of our listeners probably recall that you were the White House Deputy Chief of Staff under President George W. Bush, and you were instrumental in helping him get elected president and governor of Texas.
Well, it was a lot of fun, but I got to tell you, those races in 94 and 98 and 2000 and 2004, they pale in comparison to the election of 1896, which has got, you know, sex, violence, backstabbing, betrayal, and some really cool nicknames. That's a practice we need to bring back. Everybody needs to have a cool nickname like they had back then.
Well, I know that you're intrigued by our current race for the Republican nomination, and wow, what an amazing story this is to have a couple of guys as front runners who really have no political experience, Ben Carson and Donald Trump. This is bizarre.
Yeah, but look, it's where our country is right now. I mean, there are so many people who are so fed up with politics. This is one of the things that we share in common with the Gilded Age. One of the reasons McKinley was so attractive was that McKinley was so atypical. He was so unlike the other politicians of his age. One of the reasons that Bryan was so attractive was that he was essentially an unknown. He was thought to be, you know, not tainted by the practices of Washington and of the Congress, even though he'd served there two terms. But today we have, you know, people are just so fed up with politics that they want somebody who will pick up a brick and throw it through the plate glass window, and they have a distrust of anybody, or some element of the electorate has a distrust of anybody who has experience in that system.
I'm looking at the Trump candidacy, and I'm saying to myself, okay, people keep saying that he's going to go away, and he keeps leading in the polls, and he was sort of fading out there, and then we had this attack in Paris, and that seems to have given him a little boost. And this is a guy who almost has a machine gun technique where he just sprays wildly comments and shots at various people like bullets, and a lot of them are very inaccurate, and yet he somehow seems to get a bigger lead in the polls every time he does this. Now, if this guy is still leading by a substantial amount, say by March 15th next year, do you think there's a chance he could be the nominee?
Well, look, I think there is a chance he could be the nominee. I don't think he will be the nominee, but I think I admit that there's a chance. I think the reason he won't be the nominee is that ultimately you have to be able to unite the party and then unite the country. And how can you unite the party if you're deriding all of your primary opponents as, you know, clowns, jerks, morons, losers? I mean, there's everybody has been on the receiving end of his comments. Now, that's created a strong floor for him, but it's also created a low ceiling. You'll notice, I think in the Real Clear Politics today, he's at like 28%. He can't consistently get above 30. So you got 70% of the Republican electorate, which I think is increasingly getting the sense of, I don't like that guy. I can't bring myself to vote for him. And the question is not how do you take Trump down, but who's able to consolidate that 70% who is not for Trump, and how long will it take him to do so?
If some people decide that they've got to take him out somehow, like by running a lot of negative ads about him, some of the PACs, if that happens, do you think it's conceivable that he might be able to justify running as a third-party candidate?
Well, first of all, he says everybody has to treat me fair, which means they don't say anything bad about him and they let him win, and that's not going to happen. But I think it's hard this late in the game to really get a credible third-party independent candidacy. And after 1992, Republican states tended to make it more difficult for independent candidacies to emerge. And after Ralph Nader in 2000, Democratic states made it more difficult to emerge. And if this contest goes on to March or April or May of next year, as I think it will, I think it unlikely that Trump is going to have enough time and enough resources and enough energy to do it, because everybody has in their minds a sense of what happened the last time the center-right vote was split, and that was we got Bill Clinton. And I don't think there's going to be as much enthusiasm for, look, Ross Perot, say what you will about him. He knew what he wanted to do and could talk about it with a practicality and a specificity that made sense to people. Donald Trump, as you said earlier, just sort of machine guns things. And, you know, we have no, you know, here's a guy who several weeks ago said, we don't need to worry about ISIS. Leave it to the Russians. Let the Russians take out ISIS, or let ISIS take out Assad. I don't really care. And today it is, we've got to bomb the expletive out of ISIS. You know, here's a guy who said, we don't need to really worry about what Putin is doing in Ukraine, and I can have a good relationship with him. And where he is on that today, I don't know, but the Europeans are really scared about it, because they're saying, what is the United States willing to allow Russia to sort of take a big chunks of a European country and take them under themselves? I mean, so he's not Ross Perot, and I worry less about him running an independent candidacy for the presidency than what he does in running for the Republican nomination that taints all future Republicans. He's got misogynist comments. He's now mocking people with disabilities and then denying it. I mean, he's the guy who said, you got to see this guy, referring to the New York Times reporter who has a muscular disability that causes his arm to cramp and be largely unusable. And now he says, well, I wasn't attacking him. Well, why did you say you've got to see this guy if you claim you don't know who he is and you weren't attacking his physical disability?
Carl Rove is my guest, and reconnecting with that third-party theme and your book about William McKinley, you show in the book how McKinley unified the Republican Party, and from the time that he was elected in 1896 until 1932 when FDR was elected, the Republicans would have had an unbroken string of presidents, except in 1912 when McKinley's former vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, ran as the bull moose and cost Taft the election, and Woodrow Wilson won.
Yeah. I mean, the coalition that McKinley put in place dominates American politics for 36 years. We have the White House for 28, Senate for 30, the House for 26. We have more governors and state legislative seats than we had until today. And the mayors of most major northern cities, you know, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, St. Louis, they tended over that period of time to be Republican. New York doesn't vote for a Democrat for president until 1932, nor does Pennsylvania, nor does Illinois. And it's because of the coalition that McKinley developed. He's the first Republican to ever be endorsed by a member of the Catholic hierarchy. He does outreach to mostly Catholic urban industrial workers, many of them immigrants from Central and Eastern and Southern Europe. You know, migration was changing. We'd been a country of immigrants, but there were mainly the immigrant flows were dominated by England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, and Germany. And now there were Scandinavians and Ukrainians and Italians and Portuguese and Spanish and Czech and Bohemian. And, you know, McKinley said that the country's changing and my party has got to get these people into its ranks if we hope to win.
My guest has been Carl Rove. Carl, I have time for just one more super quick question. I understand that back in the early 70s, when you were involved with the college Republicans, that you were running for a position, and your campaign manager was the late Lee Atwater. And I was just tickled to hear this, because I thought, you know, these are two guys who have that rare gene, that rare political gene. What is it with you guys? Where do you get this?
Actually, my campaign manager was a guy from the University of Maryland named Dan Mintz.
Oh, okay.
Atwater was my Southern campaign chairman. He'd been the South Carolina chairman. And he and I campaigned through the South in a Ford Pinto that I rented with my Gulf Oil Company credit card. I was all of 22 years old. And Atwater and I became friends, and he was my executive director. I gave him his first job in Washington.
Wow. Well, we really appreciate your time, sir.
Well, I appreciate yours. Thank you, and look forward to seeing your listeners this afternoon at 1.
You have been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis.